You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It's cold, Don. It's cold.
It has finally dropped below 50 degrees a couple times at night. And as Lois and I are preparing this show, it is, first of all, October 23rd, 2024, to broadcast October 24, 2024. We do this in the morning and it's 57 degrees right now. There were a lot of days a few weeks ago when we never got down to 57 degrees in the middle of the night, much less mid to late morning. Today's high is going to be 78 degrees and sunny. Tonight, 51 degrees and clear. Thursday, 75 degrees and sunny. The most common comment we're getting from people as they walk into our garden center is, isn't this the weather we've been waiting for? Isn't this wonderful? Isn't this amazing? Yes, it's the weather we've been waiting for.
And then it's going to get cold.
Well, please define cold for me.
I have to wear a jacket when I go outside.
Okay. Then yes, I agree with you. Because Thursday night will be 45 degrees and mostly clear. Friday, partly sunny, 74. Friday night, Lois is going to wear a jacket. It's going to be 45 degrees and partly cloudy. Saturday, 78 degrees and sunny. That's Sacramento Valley weather right there. Saturday night, 53 degrees and partly cloudy. Sunday, 74 and mostly sunny. Here is the interesting change. Sunday night, a slight chance of showers. Partly cloudy with a low around 48. Monday, a chance of showers. Monday's high, although mostly sunny, is going to be 67 degrees. Monday night, slight chance of showers, partly cloudy with a low around 47. And Tuesday, sunny with a high near 67. So pretty distinct change since I just went to the Simms weather station to see what the temperatures were for the last 2 weeks. And remember that 2 weeks ago, it was 100 degrees. So we are feeling it was summer then. It's feeling like fall now. Maybe we'll even see some fall color in the next few weeks. The long-term forecast here, extended discussion Sunday through Wednesday. They continue to show the upper level trough that's bringing us the chance of rain. Moving on shore, unsettled weather pattern for the weekend into early next week for interior Northern California. By Sunday afternoon, there will be chances of rain showers spread across the mountains and valleys. They'll say this north of I-80. Okay. The National Blend of Models, which is where they take all those models and smush them together, currently shows a 40 to 80% probability of a tenth of an inch or more of rain over a 48-hour period Sunday through Tuesday. So not exactly a gully washer, but definitely a change in the pattern, cooler temperatures, washing the dust off the leaves, and a distinct feeling towards fall. High precipitation chances remain over the mountains, and there's even a probability of a quarter inch or more in the Sierra snow levels. Been a while since we've talked about snow levels. Start above 8,000 feet on Sunday, but are expected to drop below 5,000 feet Monday night. Snow totals of 3 to 6 inches are currently forecast above 6,500 feet Sunday night through the day on Tuesday. So, definitely a change in the pattern. Obviously, the fall feeling right now. Great, great weather for transplanting, moving things around, dividing perennials, scattering wildflower seed, overseeding your lawn, planting fruit. What are you doing indoors? Planting fruit trees.
I'm recording a show.
Once we're done here, I'm going out there to plant some trees. Perfect weather for it. One quick note about that. When you go out to plant a tree, your soil is probably bone dry and rock hard right now. We just planted a big tree on our property and in a new location on our driveway. And I made a point, since I had not watered that bed for over a month, it's a very low water bed. I set a hose there 4 days ahead of time to soak the area very thoroughly. I probably gave that zone about 10 or 15 gallons of water. That made it easy to dig the hole for the 15-gallon tree. Had we tried to dig the hole for the 15-gallon tree without my doing that, we'd probably still be at it. It was that dry. I have really dynamite. Yes. Well, there's a family story about that. My father, of course, had a dynamite license as a geophysicist, and that's how he made the holes for planting the trees on our property in San Diego, because it was basically sandstone. You can't do that now, but those were the 1950s. So anyway, beautiful weather ahead, and the extended forecast. The only difference is going to be a little bit of rainfall, but a lot more humid, a lot more moist, and those colder nights, we got some dew forming on the leaves and on the fruit, and you better pick quick. But they, you know, in our climate, you can still pick them, still bring them in and ripen them on the counter. We'll come back briefly to that topic, but fall is here. You know what else is here? White-crowned sparrows are here.
Yep. Yeah. And juncos. And you know, all those wildflower seeds that I sprinkled out there?
Yeah, how are they doing?
Between the crown sparrows and the dry weather when I didn't water enough, yeah. I'm not getting very many.
So the good news we had wind, you know, that's a factor. We had someone who had the same situation by overseeding their lawn a couple weeks ago. They knew they were kind of taking a gamble because it had only been 100 degrees like the day before. He's probably going to have to throw some more seed out there, but it's a percentage loss. It's not 100% failure. You get maybe 50% germination. So don't give up. Always hold back a little extra seed, just as farmers would do for the weather and the crows. Hold back a little extra seed to throw out there after you see what happens after the first time. For a small bed like yours, you might at some point want to make a really simple wire mesh thing, sort of a cage or covering, that you can scatter the seed and just set that over it until you see the seedlings germinate. And well, that's not an absolute guarantee, because I know white-crowned sparrows do, and some of their friends do, like to eat seedlings as well as seed. At least it would get them past the, you know, past the initial germination stage. And I'm finding more and more people, for a lot of these pest problems we talk about, the vertebrate pest problems, as I referred to in a recent column in the Davis Enterprise, physical barriers are effective. And they're the simplest thing you can do that isn't a chemical and that doesn't kill things and that at least gets your, you know, your plant past the danger stage. They're attracted to fruit in certain stages, seedlings at certain stages. And if you can get them past that, that may be all you need to do.
Well, if you were to look out my kitchen window, you could see the area that got cleared out and that I'm sprinkling with flower seeds. And right in the middle of it, and we love to watch, the bird bath.
Right. This is so your fault.
Like we're tracking all the birds to come to one little area. It's like, yeah, well.
Actually, this is an important point. This is an important point. I was having a conversation with someone about how to draw wildlife to the garden. And later the same day, I was having a conversation about how to not have certain things eating things in your garden. It's the same basic principle. You just flip it around. You're drawing them there by putting a bird bath there. You're encouraging them by having cover. You're having food sources. And in my article, which is in the Davis Enterprise, if you're a subscriber, I'll get it up on my website at some point, but it's in the Davis Enterprise last Sunday. And one of the main things was how to deal with these vertebrate pests, the rats, the squirrels. I didn't go into birds as much, but it, you know, I don't want people poisoning ever. And I don't really want them trapping because it's pointless. There is no point in trapping. Do you know that a rat, single female rat, can produce 100 or more babies in a single year, in multiple generations, several per gestation? You know, she can put out 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 babies each time, and she can do that several times during the course of a season. So how many rats would you have to kill by trapping, by poisoning, if you were actually doing that, to make any effect on the population? It wouldn't work. I know that, because the population will just rise back up to whatever the carrying capacity of your yard is. So you take away the food sources, you take away the cover, the habitat, and so on. And so that's kind of the gist of the article. If you're a subscriber to the Enterprise, check it out. And as I say, it'll be online at redwoodbarn.com within a week or two. But it really was just barriers is my answer, and some yard cleanup, some trimming and pruning.
Well, actually, we have a message in our mailbag about very thing. Annie writes back, thank you for your wise advice. She was talking about Rat, so this is her update. I took the easiest route possible and opened up space inside and around my tomato cages. I got rid of unnecessary vines and leaves that were yellowing and not getting much sun. My tomato plants are fairly close together in a raised bed. Since then, I've got almost 2 dozen early girl tomatoes completely rat bite free. I am very grateful for your help. And as you recall, what we talked with Annie about was making it so that the cage isn't a hiding place, so the rats don't feel nice and safe and hidden in there. They feel exposed. If you ever watch a rat go across the fence in the backyard, they'll run across the part that has open to the sky. But if it's under a tree or in a bush, oh, they can hang out there for a long time.
They can hang out in an overgrown tomato plant too. And so just trimming it away. And one thing I will say from considerable experience with this, with tree rats, squirrels, and others, what you do is a temporary thing. That cleanup was great and it'll deter them for 7, 10, 14 days. And then they'll figure out their way through there and they'll start doing some damage again. So you just do some more. But you've noticed that you were able to get in and pick some fruit and they were unblemished, undamaged. So it's something that you're trying to break up the existing cycle. My son did this just by accident. We have tree squirrels on our property and squirrels can be even worse than tree rats in many ways. I'm going to tell you, I could live with tree rats with the damage they do. 10% of the crop, fine. It's the squirrels that come in, take one bite out of fruit, knock it on the ground, move on to the next one. I've had people tell me literally every plum on the tree unripe was knocked to the ground. But he was cleaning my chainsaw and sharpened it up. And he was near my pecan tree and there was a branch we talked about taking off. And he just went ahead and cut that branch off. And I watched as the tree squirrels, which had been running this circuit through our property from tree to tree to tree, hopping from tree to branch to tree to branch, never touching the ground as they went over an area about 800 yards through the canopy, would get to the point where that branch had been and stop. They couldn't follow their usual path. And it completely discombobulated them for about 2 weeks. They were no longer running across and jumping from that point to the next. So you'd see them kind of almost like a cartoon, back up, look at each other, turn around, go back the other way and find some other way around. And it was quite a while before they found a safe way that they felt safe in to get back up into the tree where their major nest was. He had disconnected the squirrels from their main nest and they were now reduced to their satellite nests. But just by one cut, just by opening it up, now it was open to the sky and there was no place to jump from tree to tree. They had to come down to the ground to run across and go up. They don't like to do that. So again, it's not a permanent answer to the problem, but it'll get your early girl tomatoes ripe. So cleaning up, a little trimming, a little pruning can make a big difference. The next step, of course, is barriers. But just getting out there, you just being there, your smell being out there, removing the branches they're used to hiding under can actually make a big difference. And then I always urge you one more thing on this. Look around your yard for the places you wouldn't be thinking of as nesting sites for roof rats or squirrels. Now, squirrels tend to be way up in the tree somewhere, so that's not really going to be an easy option for you. But we were cleaning out a pile of 5 gallon and 1 gallon nursery pots on the side of our building that had been in one place for about 3 months. This was just a couple of months ago. There was a nest in there of tree rats. So we, you know, opened it all up and they dispersed. They'd only been there for a couple months, but they had found what was to them a safe place to make a temporary nest. And so look for those things, piles of firewood, piles of wood, kids' toys that they haven't been, you know, they're all heaped up over in the corner. That's the kind of place that'll surprise you in terms of providing nesting sites. Thank you very much for the note, Annie. Let's always start with the simplest option first and see if it works.
We have information. I actually have a catered alert in front of me.
Hey.
You know the banjo virtuoso Tony Trischka?
Mm-hmm.
This was a name to me, but I think that you're much more into that stuff than I am. Mm-hmm. Well, Rocky Outcrop, who is the host of the Yolo County Breakdown Show.
One of my favorite programmer names ever, by the way.
Rocky. In an interview on Friday, October 25th, it will air at 10 a.m. Now, we don't normally announce things that are this close because it's going to be like the day after the broadcast of our show and the day before our rebroadcast. But, you know, I got to thinking about it, and all of these music shows go for 2 weeks. So if you miss the broadcast day, go to KDRT and look for Yolo County Breakdown and just look at the archives. So here's the information about it. Banjo legend Tony Trischka joins Rocky Outcrop for a discussion of his long career as a banjo player who has taken the instrument far beyond bluegrass into the realms of jazz, avant-garde, psychedelia, experimental music, and beyond. Tony's latest album, Earl Jam, is a tribute to early bluegrass banjo player Earl Scruggs. So more information about Tony, you can go to tonytrischka.com. And for listening to the interview, you can go to Friday, October 25th, 10 a.m., kdrt.org, streaming live.
And Rocky is doing some amazing interviews of longtime musicians in Northern California. So if you have figured out the podcast thing, click on it. I think you'll really enjoy having that show download into your computer right next to Davis Garden Show, Jazz After Dark, and That's Life. Arboretum has upcoming plant sales. Let's see, Saturday, October 26th. Ooh, that's this Saturday. So it's at 9 o'clock for members and then 10 o'clock for everybody else. Of course, Davis Garden Show broadcasts at 9 o'clock. So you can listen to it on your way over there. Saturday, October 26th. This is what they call a split sale, 9 a.m. for members, 10 a.m. open to the public. You can join at the door. And then their last sale of the season, mark your calendar for Saturday, November 16th. They call it their clearance sale, 9 to 1 p.m., open to everyone. Just so you know, a few days before the sale, and they have done so already, they post the inventory of what's going to be there, at least when they open the gates. Now, I can tell you, people who go there expecting to landscape their yard based on a list from that inventory, I hear from them very commonly later that afternoon, do you have this? Do you have that? Because they do sell out of some things very quickly. So look at the quantities and have a plan in mind and be flexible about possibly an alternative variety if the one you were, you know, absolutely dead set on is already sold out. Arboretum plant sales, Saturday, October 26th. And then the last one, the clearance sale, November 16th.
And Sunday, November 3rd, we have a Rain or Shine event, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And it's Patricia Carpenter's Fall Ramble, which is always a wonderful thing. The flyer that I happen to have in front of me has an interesting picture. These are early November views of the slough taken from the West Bridge. Mm-hmm. And the photo on the left is in 2021, completely filled with water. The photo on the right in 2022, completely dry bed. Yeah. Will we have water this year? Well, we'll see. 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's drop-in time anytime you want. If you want to hear Patricia talk and do some Q&A, 10 a.m. and noon, she will be doing a short orientation. Meet at the check-in table.
You asked an interesting question there. Is it going to be a wet winter? And we are trending towards La Nina, which La Nina, when it's strong, is usually dry in Northern California. But we're trending towards a weak La Nina. And I say trending towards because it had been expected we would be in La Nina by now, by November, I should say. And we're not there yet. It's happening more slowly. This kind of placement between El Nino and La Nina, if you're familiar with those. This is the southern oscillation, movement of water that affects the temperature, is least predictable. The in-between part is the one where we have the least history, the least predictive ability with respect to whether it's going to be a wet winter. Generally speaking, I've seen some climate scientists jokingly refer to it as La Nada. You've got El Nino and you've got La Nina. Well, we're in La Nada, although we probably will be in La Nina by winter. Are typically average. Wouldn't that be amazing? Just 18, 19 inches of rain, 1 inch rainstorm a week apart, enough time for the soil to dry out and get things planted, no flooding, no drought. Wouldn't that be amazing? I've put the order in, folks. We'll see how it goes.
Thank you to Mary Kay from Folsom, who sent us a glorious picture. This is wonderful. This, she says, this Celebrity Plus took off and it is loaded. And it is. I'm looking at lots and lots of tomatoes and a very tall, vigorous vine. So thank you for those pictures. And folks, send them in. Tell us what's happening. Brag if you will. Or complain if it didn't work.
It's funny the range of comments I've gotten about tomato production this year, but almost invariably those of us that got good yields, it was because we watered deeper and longer. But yeah, this is a great picture with a lot of fruit still to ripen. So this is the important thing. You know, we're pretty well done with the tomato season, but many tomatoes are at the breaker stage on your vines right now. We're dropping into the 40s at night. The 40s won't hurt them, but it'll slow down the ripening process considerably. So that brings us to a recent podcast by my friend Fred Hoffman, Get Growing with Farmer Fred, where he talks about saving those tomatoes all the way to Thanksgiving.
So I am looking at, it's a very long article and very complicated. I got a little confused there in the middle, but then I came to this part. And this is when you have tomatoes that are still green, the breaker stage or beyond. Store these tomatoes at 55 to 70 degrees, somewhere between 55 and 70. Once the fruit is fully ripe, it can be stored at 45 or 50 with a relative humidity of 90 to 95%. Now, refrigerators are usually below 45.
Yes.
So the refrigerator is never a good place for it. But recommended refrigerator operating temperatures of 40 degrees are certainly too cool to ripen mature green tomatoes and are colder than desired for ripe ones. Yeah. Ripening enzymes are destroyed by that cold temperature, whether in the garden or in the refrigerator. Okay, now here's the key part, the part that really got to me. Ripen tomatoes in well-vented open cardboard boxes at room temperature, checking them every few days to eliminate those that may have spoiled. Mature green tomatoes will ripen in 14 days at 70 degrees Fahrenheit and 28 days at 55 degrees Fahrenheit.
So most people
now, my garage is going to be someplace in between 55 and 70 at this time of year.
So you can ripen 2 to 4 weeks for them to ripen, and then they'll hold for another week or so after that. So it's going to be, you know, Thanksgiving is the last week of November. You could easily get them to Thanksgiving and have nice fresh tomatoes from your garden on the Thanksgiving table. Be sure to take a picture and send it to your relatives back east and tell them you just went out and picked a tomato. You can lie. It's okay. It's Thanksgiving. So anyway, that's Fred does a podcast, as you may know. I've been on his show many times. We talk about tomatoes most of the time when I'm there. Get Growing with Farmer Fred, and he does publish a transcript of the podcast, which is what Lois was looking at there. You got the URL for that?
Yes. Now, this isn't the podcast. This is his website. It's right. Called Garden Basics with Farmer Fred, and the URL is gardenbasics.net. Very easy to remember, gardenbasics.net.
Yeah, and Fred's been doing broadcasting on gardening in the Sacramento Valley since the 1970s, 80s. He was, of course, a longtime broadcaster on KFBK and KSTE. I sat in with him many times over there. He's a lifetime master gardener, and he puts things in simple terms, and he doesn't dispense nonsense.
All right, next we've got up in fashion. You are told what is your fashion color for the season. Well, it turns out that they're doing this for the world now. So here we got a report from Garden Media predicts a fresh and calming hue will be reigning supreme in the garden. It's the cool garden color. It's so unexpected. Teal.
Teal. And yeah, so this, a little back up here. For as long as I've been in business, there's been some organization. It's a Pantone company does this, the Garden Something Group. They put out, this is the color of the year. And it's sort of hokey, but it's really funny how it sparks conversations. And I actually know of nurseries, because I'm on a very active nursery Facebook group, private Facebook group, where they'll take this and run with it. You know, whatever the color is, all right, they'll put, this is the color of the year, and they'll do a display. And it works, because one thing, color-themed retail displays work. So it's actually really helpful for retailers, except that sometimes we look at the color and go, huh? What are we supposed to do with that? So this year,
teal is a color that is easy with chairs and pots, and you can spray paint the metal in your garden teal. But Don, what about plants?
Yeah, that was a fun one. My staff and I were kicking this around, going, "Is there any flower that's truly teal? It's between blue and green. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. You can look it up, but it's a blue-green color, and it's a very, very interesting color." The one I immediately thought of, and I'm sure all of you thought of this right away, was Puya alpestris. It was the very first flower that I thought of, because it was the one that defined the color teal for me way back when my mother grew this plant way back in the 1960s. And if you live in Southern California, and also in Northern California, though they're just on the edge of hardiness here, Puya alpestris, and there's a couple other species, but Puya alpestris in particular, is like an agave, but much smaller. it has that kind of a look, you know, desert look. It's actually a bromeliad, but it looks like an agave. And after 10 or 15 years in the ground, her plant finally sent up this spike of blooms, and it had 50 or more blossoms on it all at once, which opened for weeks and weeks, much as agaves do. It was quite a spectacular show, and it was right out in the center of her succulent and cactus garden there in San Diego. We were on a turning circle, cul-de-sac, whatever you want to call it. Kind of depends on what part of the country you come from, but we call it a turning circle. And people would come down to the end and make the turn, would just stop and get out and take pictures of it and come up and knock on the door to ask what this flower was. It is intensely teal. So that was the one flower I could think of that's luminous teal, blue-green, if you want to call it that.
So he sent me a picture of the flower. Thank you, Don. It is a dark teal. It's not what we usually think of as teal, which is a lighter thing, but mm-hmm. there is a light teal and a dark teal, and it has bright orange pollen on it in the middle. And so it's this incredibly colorful flower. Go on Google it and look for it, because it's hard to believe that it exists. The only other flower I can think of that has that color, a color teal, not this dark, but a teal, is the Queen's Tears, because it has a multiple colors. Bilbergia is the other name, and it has multiple colors on it, but one of it is teal.
Yeah, so Bilbergia nutans or Queen's Tears. Anagazanthus, the kangaroo paw, there is a teal colored Anagazanthus. Aren't these cool names? Puya, Anagazanthus. These are very interesting plants, generally California only. Some of them are frost tender, but they are that was all we could think of in that color. And I did, you know, for a quick Google search, someone did mention hydrangea. Now, this is certainly possible because there are so many new varieties of hydrangea macrophylla, the common mop head or grandma's hydrangea, as I call it. There's pistachio green ones. There are some that are colors I don't even know how to describe. We don't sell that many hydrangeas out in this area because that's about the highest water plant there is. The name literally tells you that. I believe they even water them in rainy climates, much less out here. Although hydrangeas have their place and they're very pretty, and I happen to like the other species, but there are so many unusual color blends and shades of green and blue green. There's got to be a teal blue or teal green hydrangea out there. So that's another possibility. Beyond that, we're kind of stymied, but if you all think of flowers that are teal, we can carry this on for a couple of weeks. Send your suggestions to davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
No, I can't think of more flowers, but there are some cactusy-like things, succulents and stuff, that have a light teal color.
Yeah, and the foliage. Yeah. Foliage is kind of blue-green. So it's blue-green is what we would describe it as, but it's really an unusual color. It's not turquoise, it's teal. And that's the color of the year, folks. So we expect all your gardens to be full of teal flowers, but you'll have to do a little research to figure out which ones you're going to use. And my thanks to Martha Stewart for sending this information out into my email.
Okay. So here's some questions that came in. And, you know, Don writes down these things when he overhears them in the store. And this one is, do you have Meyer lemon trees?
Yes, we have Meyer lemon trees almost all the time.
Are they the dwarf ones?
Well, Meyer lemon is a naturally dwarf citrus.
No, but do you have the true dwarf ones?
Okay, so here's where we get into the conversation. True dwarf citrus was actually trademark a marketing term from Four Winds Growers that they came up with 30 plus years ago for the citrus that they grafted onto a very slow, a rootstock which caused the top to grow much more slowly than usual. Flying dragon rootstock, a type of citrand rootstock. It's a hybrid between an orange and the trifoliate orange, which is a different genus in the same family. The rootstock is very recognizable. A little side note here. If you ever see a shoot come up from ground level or even from the top couple inches above the ground and it has a three-part leaf, that's the rootstock of the trifoliate orange. So you should remove that because it doesn't have edible fruit, but it's a rootstock. And a bunch of rootstocks have that. They had one in particular that caused this much slower growth rate. That was called true dwarf citrus. It's been probably 10 or more years ago they stopped using that rootstock completely for a bunch of reasons that I could explain, but it's another conversation. It's a whole show on citrus rootstocks. Maybe someday we'll do one. But the point is, they went away from that. And in fact, they removed true dwarf citrus from all of their marketing materials. So the answer to the question is no, I don't, nor does anybody else have true dwarf citrus. The effect of that particular flying dragon rootstock was that let's say a mandarin or a Meyer lemon that would grow 2 to 3 feet a year on another normal, shall we call it, rootstock would only grow a foot a year. It doesn't mean it doesn't get as big. It just takes twice as long to do it. In fact, I have a very good example of that on my farm. I got a bunch of Satsuma mandarins, Owari Satsuma mandarins, on the flying dragon rootstock in the 1980s. And I planted them, and six of them I headed out when they were young to keep them under 8 feet. 35 years later, I have very easily and effectively kept them under 8 feet. Two of them, I decided, these are on the county road. People steal the fruit anyway. What the hell? Leave them here and don't prune them. Just let them grow as big as they want to get. And 35 years later, these true dwarf Owari Satsuma mandarins are 15 by 15 feet. Is that dwarf? Is that true dwarf? No, it got almost as big, if not just as big as it would have on a regular rootstock. It just took twice as long to do it. So that's the first thing you need to know about most dwarfing or semi-dwarf rootstocks. They don't reduce the size of the tree overall. They just slow down the growth rate. You still need to do some training or pruning to keep them smaller. It was very easy. I just took the center out of the others, and I can pick all the fruit off the ones that I did that to, and I can only pick half the fruit off the two that I left full size. It's not what people are thinking. It doesn't keep the plant 4x4 or anything like that. But the main thing is, true dwarf rootstock is no longer out there. I don't know of anyone that's using one that you could really call that. So that's why we all kind of wince and go, oh, they're semi-dwarf. Well, I want the true dwarf. Well, you just aren't going to get it. That's the problem. All of my
growth. That's a marketing term, and the market is no longer.
The product is no longer. The product is no longer on the market. Now, here's an interesting wrinkle to this. Meyer lemons and certain limes are actually frequently just rooted cuttings. Very unlike most other citrus, they're often, and the ones I prefer to sell you, are not actually even on a rootstock. They root easily. Might be interesting to know that. If you happen to have a way to root things, those two in particular form roots quite readily from cutting. So it's an easy way to get a new plant. And they make an acceptable plant. They don't need the rootstock that is sometimes used for other reasons on other citrus and other fruit trees. So very commonly, and you can tell looking at the tree in your garden center or your hardware store, whether it's been grafted or not. On its own roots, Meyer lemon grows naturally about a foot or so a year, tops out in 10 years at about 6 feet or so, but will eventually get bigger. We have one listener who I know, I've seen a picture of her Meyer lemon. It's about 12 by 12, at least in the last picture I looked at. It's also as old as her house. So it's what, 30 years old, something like that. So they can get bigger. But Meyer lemon, which is not a true lemon, it's considered to be a cross between a mandarin and a lemon that occurred either naturally or intentionally in China hundreds of years ago. Nobody knows the exact parentage. It grows more like a mandarin. It's a bushier, denser, tighter, smaller tree, naturally. And on its own roots, that's what it does without any real effort on your part. At some point, if it's getting more than 6 or 7 feet tall, you should probably decide if you want to let it do that, because it'll be hard to get at the fruit. There are thorns on there, not as bad as true lemons, but there are thorns. And so you might make the decision that you're going to start pruning it to keep it, say, 6x6. Very easy to do with the Meyer lemon. So some pruning involved. No true dwarf is not available anymore. Meyer lemon is not actually a lemon. So this is not a monster like some of the other lemons we can talk about in a moment. But it naturally is a compact, bushy plant. And in fact, it's one of the best to grow in a container. If you happen to want to grow a citrus in a tub or a barrel or something, Meyer lemon is one of your best choices.
So, Don, I've heard that the Meyer lemon is bushy and compact and dense, and you know, you can hurt yourself trying to get in there in the middle and get the lemons. I'm wondering if that is a tree rat thing. In other words, if I had a Meyer lemon and I had tree rats in the neighborhood, would I do what I do with my tomatoes, which is thin it out a little bit so it's more open to the sky? Would that help?
Yeah, the density of some citrus does provide cover, and people who have Meyer lemons often do find they get tree rat damage on them because it is a nice, dense, solid place that they could hang out. I will never forget a lady walking in a couple of years ago with a branch, just carrying it in to say, I need to know what did this. And hanging on the branch were several lemons, Meyer lemons, that had been peeled. The fruit was still there. The peel had been methodically removed. I mean, as if someone somewhat obsessive had sat there and taken it off. I said, well, that's exactly what happened. It was what a tree rat did. They felt comfortable enough to hang out there long enough. Think about this. They don't have opposable thumbs. Imagine if they did. So they're using their funny, clumsy little hands and their extremely effective teeth, and they're carefully removing the peel from a fruit. How long would that take? I mean, it can't, even with their adaptability, it can't be that fast. And they nevertheless took all of the peels off all of the fruit on that branch. Just that branch. So wherever that branch was on the tree, this tree rat and probably some of her kids felt safe enough to spend the time to remove the peel. And I did comment, just for the record, the fruit's perfectly usable if you can handle that, but she was a little grossed out by it. So yes, the Meyer lemon, and I've seen the same with, you know, Satsuma mandarin, some of the others that have almost all the mandarins, clementines, and all of them have a pretty dense growth habit. So that could lead to, as you say, a place where rats could hang out or squirrels could hang out. I also almost always find birds' nests in my citrus trees on my farm because of that density. Birds also like that cover. So there's that. How do we encourage wildlife without encouraging vertebrate pests? That's a trade-off. But if you're concerned about it making habitat, you would just thin the tree out somewhat. Again, the other thing is Meyer lemons, once they're established and producing, produce so much fruit. I mean, she had 5 or 6 fruit that had been peeled that she didn't want to use, but she probably had another 300 on the tree. So it's like, if you don't mind sharing a little bit, this is something that you can live with. Meyer lemon is hardy-ish. It's not a... It's not completely hardy to the kind of cold we've had here occasionally. A major freeze event could injure a Meyer lemon. The tree tends to come back real well. The fruit with a fairly soft skin such as it has, and if that fruit happens to be on the outer part of the tree and we get down into the mid-20s, that fruit can be injured. So people who are hearing we're going to have a, you know, a significant frost event might want to go out, and they always send me notes. Should I pick all my fruit? No, if you're concerned about it, pick the exposed fruit. Because the tree itself, with that density that protects tree rats and birds' nests, also protects the fruit that's on the inside. So if you've got fruit that's right out open to the sky and you're concerned we're going to get to, say, 25, 26 degrees, that could cause fruit injury. Pick that fruit if it is ripe. But the other thing about citrus is they're not climacteric fruit. They don't ripen once you pick them. So that lemon better be close to usable because it's not going to get probably much sweeter after you pick it. Anyway, Meyer lemons are a great choice here on their own roots. They're sort of naturally dwarf. There are no true dwarf citrus out there. And point of fact, I order citrus from 3 and sometimes a 4th suppliers, and they all are using the same rootstock now here in California. They're all using the C35 Citrans rootstock, and they call it semi-dwarf. And at this point, I just take a Sharpie and I scribble that semi-dwarf out on the label because I don't want people to ask about what it actually means. To me, the word semi-dwarf is an oxymoron. There, it's a great choice for people who are limited for space. And then her next question was?
We already answered it. She asked about limes.
So limes are a different beast. Limes are a little tender here. We're in Northern California. We're in USDA Zone 9. We're in Sunset Zone 14. Limes of the type most people are thinking of, Mexican lime, key lime, same thing. They're the same plant. Are too tender for us to grow successfully in Northern California. Almost every winter they get injured. So you'd have to have it in a very sheltered location. We sell the Tahitian, Persian, or Bears lime, B-E-A-R-S-S. That is a true lime. It does grow here. It's hardy enough to grow in Northern California without injury in a normal winter or even in a relatively cold winter. The fruit is a lime. It tastes like a lime, but the difference is it ripens yellow. And so people think, I didn't get a lime. I must have gotten some kind of lemon because it does fully ripen yellow. One, you can use it green if you want. It's a lime, so you're not waiting for it to get sweet, and the flavor is perfectly good before it turns color. And when it turns color, it is somewhat sweeter and perfectly, it's a lime. It's just exactly what you're thinking of. It's not the Mexican lime or bartender's lime, but it is a true lime. So in Northern California, I only suggest the Bears or Persian lime because it is reliably hardy. And that's one they also grow from cuttings very commonly. Some growers graft them, probably just because that's their production method and it's easier for them to do. Very important to know if they have, just so you can watch for root suckers. There's nothing wrong with getting them grafted. It may lead to a more vigorous tree, but not likely. But more to the point, if something comes up from below the graft, and it will be very obvious with that three-part leaf, snap that off. I don't even cut them off. If I'm walking along and looking at a citrus tree and a little shoot has come up from below the graft union, I just take my thumb and snap it right off at the trunk, breaks off clean. If you get that early, it's the simplest thing in the world. If you let it go, it can overtake the tree. And those are very sad conversations when someone tells me, I planted a grapefruit and I only got a couple grapefruit on it, but now the rest are all really sour and awful tasting. And I said, oh, can you take a picture and bring it in and I'll look at it? And they do. And I go, well, unfortunately, 3/4 of your tree is rootstock. It got overtaken several years ago. This branch is your grapefruit. The rest is rootstock. That all has to be pruned out. Honestly, at this point, if it were mine, I'd just dig it out and start over. But if you catch that little root sucker when it first came up, you can snap it off with your thumb and solve that problem. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Well, here's another one that came in. This was a mid-October. And yep. The question is, do you have any winter melons?
Winter melon starts, presumably, she was asking for seedlings to plant in her garden. Usually we get winter squash question. I'm looking for winter squash, you know, like acorn squash, Hubbard squash, things like that. Why do we call these winter squash?
Because they're stored in the winter.
Yes. And it's an unfortunate.
You harvest them in the fall and you can keep them all winter. I mean, back in Michigan, we had a root cellar where we had all sorts of stuff stored for the winter.
I think a root cellar is a brilliant idea, but nobody has them here, partly because, of course, we can grow things out in our garden during the wintertime. But I thought maybe there's a thing called a winter melon, but I said, which did you have in mind? Oh, you know, honeydew. Ah, okay. So she was thinking of a regular melon, you know, cantaloupe, honeydew, Crenshaw, that type, some of which take 90 to 110 days from when you plant the plant, and you're usually planting the plant in, let's say, the 1st of June, a lot of climates, which means you're not harvesting those until September or October. And then, yes, some of them have a hard enough, waxy enough peel, skin, that you can store them for a while. Some of them you can store for a surprisingly long time. This has been going on for thousands of years, where people have found melon varieties that you can store. Root cellar would be ideal, or in similar conditions as those tomatoes we were talking about, 50, 55 degrees, down into the 40s is probably okay. Monitor them. And you could keep some melons and eat them as much as 4 or 5 weeks later, which gets you pretty close to the winter. Winter melon, if you go to Wikipedia, you'll find an actual thing called a winter melon, but that is definitely not what she was referring to. She was just thinking of these very, very long season melons and the fact that you can store them. Our industry doesn't do it. People, you know, and gardening seed companies don't do people any favors when we come up with names like winter squash and winter melon, because it suggests to them that this is something you'll be growing and eating in the wintertime. No, it's a grown through the summer, and then harvested in the fall, and some of them in particular, pumpkins and the winter squash and things like that, can be stored all the way into and through the winter if you do it correctly. And some melons can also be done that way.
And pumpkins, some kind of pumpkins, are jack-o'-lanterns. Mm-hmm. And those have to be planted earlier. When you've got that September questions, we want to grow jack-o'-lanterns.
Yeah.
Starts here in September.
Almost every year we get someone coming in, usually a dad with kids, and they'll come in September and they want to grow jack-o'-lanterns. And so we just talk to them to mark your calendar. This is one of the best uses for Google calendars I've ever come up with. Mark your calendar for June, or actually the jack-o'-lantern trade in California, they generally plant, I learned this years ago, about July 1 for the jack-o'-lantern market, for the Halloween market, because they can harvest them in September or early October, and they can get them out to the stores in time. So it takes about 3 months for them to grow and develop, 3 to 4 months. Generally speaking, the month of June is your time for planting all of these things. Winter squash, many of these melons and pumpkins are some of the last things I plant in my summer vegetable garden. I get all the important things in. These are all space consumers. They take a lot of room. They can be fun. I really do recommend, if you've got a vegetable garden, you got the space for them, growing a pumpkin pumpkin vine is very entertaining, especially if you have young kids. They literally grow a few inches a day. So it's kind of impressive. They do need a lot of water. They want to run somewhere. They can't take competition. But we generally plant those. I put them on the last emitters that I still don't have anything on the edge of the garden where they can run out into the field. Or if you're in a smaller garden, run, say, behind the vegetable planter boxes or across your lawn if you don't mind not mowing it for the whole summer. And then you'll be harvesting in September, October. So that's when you plant for jack-o'-lanterns and pies and all that kind of thing. They're all easy to grow. The one key thing to know, all this group, winter melons, all types of melons, all of those types of squash that are the keeper type squashes, they're deep rooted. They do need a lot of water, but you can water them like your tomatoes. So I've generally put these on my tomato line, which I'm running longer and less often. Summer squash, where the fruit develops rapidly and doesn't, and drought is, you know, can be very, very detrimental. That you generally put on the line with your peppers and eggplant and basil and things that you're watering more frequently. But these keeper type squashes, pumpkins, and melons can be deep watered fairly infrequently as long as they don't get severely drought stressed. Give them space, lots of fun, very entertaining.
So I have an update on the chip situation. As you may have heard, back in May, Lois ordered a chip drop and it came in June. And well, it's been being worked on ever since. Mm-hmm. And my update is, as of the 20th of October, we still have a car size pile of chips in the driveway. We're hoping to move it before it gets too wet. Into the backyard and just put it in a place where we can have it as a reserve so we can take it out when we need it.
Well, if you don't get it, okay, get it moved before the rains, just go ahead and take a California poppy plant, put it at the very top of the pile, and let it bloom through the winter.
All right. So we have one more thing that I want to talk to you about. And this was an article that someone sent us. The article itself was in the Washington Post. But the question is, will this American fruit outcompete apples and peaches as farm crops or orchard crops in a hotter planet? And the question is, Papa, a resilient native fruit, yes, which has a cult following, I'm told.
Okay. Yeah. No, it will not replace apples. What were the other choices?
Peaches?
No.
As the climate gets warmer up in the north. This was up by Canada that these farmers were growing their pawpaw fruit.
Sure. So pawpaw is native to the southeastern United States. It is apparently quite easy to grow. I've always understood it to be an understory tree. So I, you know, maybe in a milder climate, you could do an orchard of it in full sun. All right. Here is on one of my long database compilations that will someday be published as a book, what I wrote about pawpaw. First of all, I've tasted them. I was talking to one of our leading California rare fruit grower chapter members here in Davis who had some and brought them by the nursery so we could all try them a couple of years ago. And we all had the same reaction. This is another one of those sweet, mild, sort of custard-like fruit. Okay. And there's a lot of the subtropical fruits that are in that category where I don't know what I would do with 500 of them or even 100 of them, but they're interesting. They're native to the southeastern United States. But this is what I actually wrote, which will perhaps go into my edibles book someday. They're hardy. Do you really want a pawpaw? Okay, you need two trees of different varieties to cross-pollinize. The crushed leaves smell like diesel fuel. Pollinated by carrion flies and beetles. The flowers smell like rotting meat. So this alluring idea comes from a website, quote, "I have hung chicken bones to attract carrion flies to the flowers, and others have used this practice to improve pollination." Or this from Wikipedia, "Growers of pawpaw sometimes place rotting fruit or roadkill meat near the trees at bloom time to increase the number of pollinators." Charming. So the answer to the question is no, they probably won't replace those things. They do grow in the Sacramento Valley, if you're interested. But to me, based on the description, how people are growing them and where they've succeeded with them, it would be better in a place like where you'd have a dogwood or a Japanese maple or something like that. So the bright shade of another tree, and remember, you need two of them, a couple of different kinds. So nevertheless, I'm always interested in a fruit. And my question was, okay, can nurseries get this? And I started, you know, looking around. There is a nursery in the Southeast that grows them and sells them. They're challenging for the nursery industry because they're taprooted. And so taprooted plants that make a rapid taproot without much branching, pecans, walnuts are in the same category, have to be grown in long sleeves and handled very carefully. And so very few places are willing to do pawpaws for mail order sales or anything like that. But if you do a little searching, you'll find someone like Tai Tai Nursery down in the Southeast, or maybe Rain Tree up in the Pacific Northwest. You can probably get a hold of them. Be prepared to nurture them their first season as they root out, because they don't have a lot of a root system when you get them. And I would certainly, if you're going to put them in full sun, I would certainly shade the young trees while they're getting going, and they do need plenty of water. Think about where they come from, the southeastern United States. So I don't think they're ever going to be drought tolerant. I'm sure, as with many trees that have been selected for different characteristics, fruit and vegetable plants, there's probably varieties that are better than others. The ones we tasted, mild, sweet, pleasant, interesting, custard-like texture. So there's a lot of fruit in that category where I just don't know what you would do with it other than just eat it like that. So it's not going to replace apples, because I don't think you'll ever see pawpaw sauce. It's not going to replace peaches, because I don't think you'll ever see a pawpaw pie. But it's something that you would grow for fun and interest. And if you are interested in fruits like this, this is where I always refer people to the California Rare Fruit Growers. They've been around since the 1960s. They have a number of publications on all these different and unusual fruit. If it's weird, there's a paper on it somewhere in their archives. And they have a very active chapter here in Northern California, in Sacramento area. They have active chapters all around the state, and they're very active on Facebook. So if you're interested in the simple question, are there better pawpaw varieties for this area, wherever you're listening, that would be where I would go first, is CRFG, California Rare Fruit Growers, social media, or right to their website. I don't think that these mild flavored fruit are going to ever become anything more than a small niche within the fruit market. I don't think you're going to get that many people who want something that doesn't have a little more acidity, a little more tang, a little more interest to the flavor. But it could be a fun thing to grow. If you're doing a food forest, any of you out there doing food forests, you could probably have a pawpaw in the shade of your pecan, and that would be a very natural combination that would occur even where both of those trees are native.
So Don, I have a question about roots. When you're talking about taking out a plant and planting something else, like we're switching from summer to winter flowers, for example.
Ripping out the zinnias and planting snapdragons, yes.
Okay, so, but when we talk about other things, frequently I've heard you say, just cut it down and let the roots decay and make those channels in the soil and all that other stuff. Can we do that and just plant a new plant next to where the old roots are? Or do we have to actually rip the roots out of the ground?
I cut them off. I do the same thing with flowers that I do with vegetables. And for the most part, I know those roots will simply disintegrate and do what you're describing. They'll amend the soil locally. They'll make the macro pores that allow water and nutrients to move more rapidly. So I just cut them down. Now, having said that, there are certain plants that if you cut them down, will resprout. Right. Most of those are kind of short-lived perennials. And there's some of them that I actually like for that purpose. Two in particular, pinks. Dianthus, you probably know cottage pinks, which are like a carnation, but single flowers, nice light fragrance. My experience with those is they get rough looking, cut them to the ground, put something next to them, a snapdragon, a pansy, a viola, whatever. The pinks will push right back up and bloom again and bloom right through the winter in the case of that particular plant. The other one that I really like for this, and folks can use this in containers as well, are some of the herbaceous salvias, the sages, ornamental sages, particularly Salvia farinacea, like Victoria Blue, just spiky light blue flowers. Great filler for mixed plantings, and it can get rough and ratty looking. It's not really an annual. It's really a short-lived perennial, but people treat it like an annual. Cut it to the ground, put in your snapdragons, pansies, whatever, it'll push right back up and bloom with them. So I always like to cut them down, and I sometimes get unexpected results. The commercial landscapes always do this one thing. They rip everything out, they turn in a bunch of stuff, and they plant new. All right, that's fine, but it's a little extreme in my opinion.
Want to talk about roots, Don?
We did. We leave them there.
No.
Don't worry about them.
No, that's not my question, though. All right, so what is it that decomposes the roots when they're in the ground? I mean, earthworms don't come and nibble on them or anything. What is it? Is it bugs? Is it, what is it?
various fungal and bacterial organisms that create compost out of organic material that's put in. So okay. Anything you put in the soil, there's these things that break it down. And if it's roots, it's just like if you have leaves on the ground, it's the same organisms.
All right. So this is good information. I really like this. Now, here I have a pot. I bought a bag of good soil. It's good potting soil. I put it in the pot. I grew a plant in it. Now, if I cut that off and leave the roots there, are the roots going to just sit there or are they going to decompose? And how do the little critters in there get there to decompose them?
They're already in the soil. Every form of soil that you buy already has fungus and bacteria in it. Nobody sterilizes soil. There is no such thing as truly sterile soil. So it arrives in your bag that goes into your pot all ready to go to break those things down. Also, they can invade through the hole in the bottom, I suppose. Sometimes earthworms get up there that way. But there is those organisms are in there. And so when you cut something off in a container, same thing as in the ground. The roots will decay. Obviously, they can't sustain themselves since nothing is feeding them anyway. So the cells will simply collapse anyway. But there are things that will break them down and turn them into compost, basically. They're present in the soil. They're in the soil that you bought.
And how long should I wait before I plant the new plant in there?
I don't wait at all. I do the exact same thing in containers that I just described in garden beds. I have in my backyard, someday I'll take a picture of this, but I'd have to clean it all up before I could ever post a picture. I have about 80 large containers in my backyard, mostly 15-gallon size, that kind of thing. I just went through and cut down a bunch of old overgrown. I cut down some dahlias that were pretty much done. I cut down some of the marigolds that were looking rough because of thrips. I just cut them to the ground. I top it off with 2 to 3 inches of the same soil that I usually use so that I have, you know, no major phase difference between different soil types. So I'll just top it off with 2 to 3 inches of the good quality potting soil. And then I'll take a trowel and I'll plunge it down in there to get through the new soil into the soil below, and I'll plant right into that combination. I've been doing this for years. So I don't take out all the soil in all those 80 plus containers every time I change them over to new things that I'm planting. I just cut the thing down and top it off. Now, if you're an orderly sort of person, which I'm not, if you're an orderly sort of person, things are going to come back up. Like I mentioned with the salvias and the others, some of those things are going to re-sprout. So if you don't want that to happen, you do have to pull those out rather than just cut them off. Otherwise, it's just sort of a fun addition to the things you're planting to have a salvia pop back up or whatever else is in there. I mean, I discovered this years ago with cyclamen. I would be leaving them in containers, fully intending to dig them up and move them somewhere else or something. No, that wouldn't happen. So it just, all right, add some soil, plant around them. Hey, look, the cyclamen is blooming again. So I work with what's there. You can cut things down in containers. You can top dress with new soil. The only reason for changing out the soil would be if you're concerned about a disease problem, like you've grown a tomato and it shows some evidence of a root disease or something. That's really unusual in containers, by the way. So if you have that concern, you might dump that soil out, go buy a whole new bag of soil and fill it up and all that kind of stuff. I don't do that. I just top dress with the existing soil that I use and I let those roots break down. 9 times out of 10, they just disintegrate. Whatever I planted is now what's in that container. Sometimes something will pop back up and surprise me. I think that's fun. But if you're an orderly sort of person, you rip it all out and start over. Fine.
So Don, people have noticed that our website is, well, truncated. And I want to let everybody know what happened. The website was accidentally removed and Don put back up the current things. But the old stuff, the archived stuff on the website wasn't there. So I have a copy of the website that ends in 2020. And I am in the process of redoing that, of organizing it, of making sure everything is right. And then I'll be putting that up with the new stuff intermixed with it. So if you're looking for our old archives, well, be patient. So we're going to close the show with another quote. This one is another author, unknown quote. Sorry about that, folks. With landscaping, you never seem to reach a point when you feel the job is completely done.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.